Broadcasted live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
But you have to do the evil laugh.
How are you, Sheldon?
I'm finding you.
Okay, what are we doing today?
So today we are... Today's Halloween.
Yes,
it's Halloween.
It is today.
So I thought, let's do a Halloween theme. But, you know, I'm an educator. So my thing is like to educate people about things. And so the tradition of Halloween dates back 2,000 years. And originally it's actually three holidays in one.
Yeah.
It's All Souls Eve, it's All Hallows Eve, and All Saints Eve.
Yeah.
And they call it All Hallowtide. Now, in the old religion,
yes,
it's one of the feast days. So
yes.
So the one is Christmas. The other one is Easter.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the third. And all of these feast days have an eve. And in the eve, what they do is they have a vigil,
mm-hmm,
that leads up to the actual holiday, which is the next day.
Mm.
And I remember as a child, as a Roman Catholic, as a child, we would... my mother was very observant. And actually, it's considered to be like a day of observation. So it's a compulsory day. And I think it's been loosened up over the years. But I remember my mother going to church the day before and then going to church the day of. And then the whole thing is about a remembrance of the ancestors or your family members that came before, like a remembrance of people that have come and gone. And then on that day, especially in Portugal, which is where we are from, you would go to the cemeteries. The cemeteries then get cleaned, and then you put new flowers out for the people that have come before. And so it's this whole celebration of people that have come before. Now, in the old days, what they do is they'd have a black parade.
Mm.
So what would happen is people would get dressed up in black. There'd be criers, people crying and mourning, and there'd be a parade through the streets. And that whole costumey thing probably emanated from that.
Mm.
And then there'd be these things called soul cakes, which are similar to what you call hot cross buns for Easter.
Mm-hmm.
And these soul cakes would be traded, almost like a trick or treat kind of, so you can see where the tradition comes from. And the holiday in the United States only seems to have come into play like in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And there, a lot of the ideas of horror and all of that stuff started coming into being.
Mm.
Also, the Protestants sort of were against the whole tradition of old souls, saying that it was like, celebrating evil, and which it wasn't, and I think a lot of that horror element came out of that whole reneging on like what the All Hallowtide was all about.
Mm.
But anyway, let's get back to Thriller. So Thriller is like the international anthem for Halloween.
Yes.
If you want to do a Halloween, you can't do it without the Thriller. And so this song was the title song from Michael Jackson's second album with Sony. He'd already released five before that with Motown. And then the first album with Sony was Off the Wall, which was a huge success, 20 million albums. But when he started working on Thriller, he told Quincy Jones, this album is going to be the biggest selling album of all time. And everyone's like, yeah, you're a kid. What do you know about the biggest selling album of all time? Anyway, so the album's released and it does very well. I mean, at one point it was selling 1 million units a week.
Mm-hmm.
It was huge. But and then the sales started declining.
Mm.
And Michael Jackson was obsessed with his numbers.
Mm.
He was obsessed with like keeping the numbers up. So so the album was released in 1982. By 1983, the sales started to diminish. Six singles had been released from the album, and that's a lot in any time.
Mm.
But considering that the album only had nine songs on it, so the majority of the album had been released.
Mm.
Michael went to Walter Yetnikoff, who was the head of Sony, and said, I want to release Thriller.
Mm.
And Walter was like, who wants to hear a song about monsters?
Mm.
You know, like, it doesn't make any sense. And he was like, and I want a $1 million to make a music video for Thriller. Now, by that stage, a record company is like, we've already really pushed this album. It's like we've pushed it, like six singles, six music videos. We've pushed this thing to death. There's nothing more in it. And so they weren't very keen on like funding a music video. So anyway, Michael Jackson lands up finding the money through different sources or whatever, and they decide to do a documentary of the making of it to try and like generate additional income. But Michael Jackson was like, this song is going to be a hit and you need to bank on this. The whole concept behind the song was written, the song was written by Rod Temperton. And Rod was like, he knew that Michael Jackson had a thing for films and he wanted to write something cinematic. So this, when you listen to the song, it sounds like a theme from a movie. It's got like levels and it like builds up. And it's got like layers and it's very cinematic. They even got a guy called Vincent Price who does the monologue in the song. And Vincent Price was a very famous actor in the 1930s and he was a famous villain. And so they brought him on. He did the monologue in the thing, very spooky. The music video is then released. It's the biggest selling music video of all time to this day. And it becomes this huge success. It only peaks at number three on the charts. But the units, the sales are like astronomical. 9 million units sold around the world. It's massive. And everyone's like, oh, we're so surprised that this was a hit. And Michael Jackson was like,
but we knew this
was going to be a hit. And because of the success of the single, the album goes back to number one, starts reselling all over again. And today, it is the biggest selling album of all time, 70 million units sold. If you add the single sales to the album sales, over 100 million units sold of this whole product called Thriller.
Wow. We've got more music coming up as we celebrate Halloween, right?
Yes.
So, Santana.
Yeah.
The legend.
The legend. Yeah. I mean, when you hear that,
that guitar
soloing, it can only be Santana.
Yes.
Carlos Santana. And he is an iconic Latin guitarist. But this song, Black Magic Woman, was actually written by a guy called Peter Green, who was one of the founders of Fleetwood Mac. And the song was originally released by Fleetwood Mac in 1968. But then, and the song was about Peter Green's ex-girlfriend, which he called a magic woman, a black magic woman. So not, I don't think a good reference. Anyway, and so Santana then released the song 2 years later in 1970. And he added more of like a Latin, so originally it was more like a blues song. And this, so he then experimented more with like a Latin psychedelic rock sound on this version of Black Magic Woman. And in his version, he had, he assimilated ideas of this other song called Gypsy Queen by an artist called Gabor Szabo, which was a song that was released in 1966. So he took those concepts and added them to create this new version of Black Magic Woman. So the original version didn't do anything on the charts, but the Santana version. So Santana, so it was Carlos Santana and Santana, and Santana was the band. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and this version went to number four in the United States. And although it never charted in the UK, it sold 200,000 units in the UK, which is quite interesting because sometimes you think a song needs to do really well in order to generate big sales. But I mean, it's not always the case. Mm. And because the thing is that a song can be around for a very long time and then people buying like...
rediscover it.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden it's selling big units, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's enough for it to chart. But before you know it, you've sold a million, you know, and it's never charted.
Yes.
So, and the song only eventually became a hit. So although it was recorded in 1970, like with Thriller, it was only really a hit like a year later in 1971. Mm. So it became a big hit then. Which sort of takes us to the next song, which is Superstition.
Stevie Wonder. Yeah.
So the big story behind Stevie Wonder and Superstition was that the song was actually written, well, it wasn't even written. It was included in Stevie Wonder's 15th studio album called Talking Book.
Mm-hmm.
And Stevie Wonder was iconic by this stage. I mean, he was... so this is 1972, and he's building up to the big, like, Songs in the Key of Life, which is 1976. But Stevie Wonder was a big fan of, like, collaborating with a lot of people.
Mm.
So although he wrote all of the songs himself, he liked having different musical influences in his music. And he heard about this guy called Jeff Beck, who was, like Santana, an iconic blues guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Beck apparently said he was this massive Stevie Wonder fan. And so when Stevie Wonder heard about this, he was like, I need you to come and play on my album, Talking Book.
Mm.
Anyway, they struck up a deal. And the deal was Jeff Beck would play on Talking Book and Stevie Wonder would write him a song.
Mm.
So if you play on my album, I'll write you a song.
Mm.
So Jeff Beck came in and he played on a whole lot of songs on Talking Book. And in the downtime when they were recording, they started improvising together and whatever, and sort of lay the foundations for the song called Superstition. Anyway, when the song was completed, Stevie Wonder offered the song to Jeff Beck as a gift. Thank you for doing this thing for me, wada, wada, wada. Anyway, Jeff Beck then formed a supergroup to release the song, but it was delayed. And in the interim, Berry Gordy, the owner of Motown Records, which is the company that Stevie Wonder was signed to, heard Superstition. And he was like, oh, but this song is going to be a big hit. You need to release it, Stevie Wonder. And Stevie was like, no, I promised the song to Jeff Beck. Now, there's this whole thing in the music industry. It's called the first rule doctrine, which basically says that the first time you release a song, you can control who will release that song. Once that song is released to the public, anyone can record it. So as long as they ask for permission and pay for the rights to do so. But you can't prevent someone from recording the song. So Stevie Wonder said to Berry Gordy, but I've promised the song to Jeff Lynne. I can't, you know, renege on that wish. And Berry Gordy was like, you must release the song. Anyway, Stevie Wonder releases the song and it goes to number one. It's a number one hit. Goes to number 11 in the UK. It sells 2 million units. It's huge. For an African-American artist to like hit the mainstream like that in the 1970s was a massive thing. And Jeff Beck releases his version a few months later. It's not as big as the Stevie Wonder version, but Berry Gordy was right. It was going to be a big hit.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, can anybody ignore this woman? You cannot.
Nina Simone.
You can try.
But just to get back to the Stevie Wonder song, that song, Superstition, was the theme of the song is about like how people are negatively impacted by superstitions and it like prevents them from doing things like Friday the 13th. Some people won't go out on Friday the 13th because they freaked out by all of that stuff. But Nina Simone, when I first heard her, I thought it was a guy because she's got that deep voice.
Yeah.
And but she was such a queen of like being able to interpret songs. Now, this song is a cover version. She did, most of her songs were cover versions because she didn't really write her own music. And the original was released in 1956 and it was done by a guy called Screaming Jay Hawkins. And his version's a lot more aggressive and bigger than her version. The song was included on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame songs that shaped rock and roll. It was also on the Rolling Stone 500 Greatest Songs of All Time. When Screamin' Jay Hawkins was writing the song, he intended to write a very refined blues song. But then what happened was his producer, Arnold Maxson, brought, on the night they were recording the song, he brought like chicken wings and alcohol into the studio, and what was meant to be a soul ballad became this like spooky, crazy song that emerged out of this fruit salad called alcohol and chicken wings. Anyway, so it didn't turn out the way that he had initially intended. Anyway, and so his wife, actually Anna May, stated that she wrote the song and he took credit for the song. So obviously there's beef all over the place and maybe a little bit of chicken as well. But anyway, the song was then covered by many artists, but the most famous version is this Nina Simone version. Now, the song, the album on which the song appears is also called I Put a Spell on You. by Nina Simone, and it was released in 1965. Now, Nina Simone was a uber snob. Like,
oh, but my goodness. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The grand dame of snobbery.
Yeah.
She was a Juilliard-trained pianist.
Yeah.
And she frowned upon all of this pop music stuff because she was like, I am a legitimate musician.
And she was. Yeah.
I don't do this pop music thing. But then obviously pop music pays the bills.
Mm.
And she didn't even want to be a singer initially. Mm. She was like, I'm a piano player. I'm a pianist.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about her piano. Because she started playing quite early on in her life.
Started playing quite early and then finally got funded to go to study.
By this wonderful woman who just kind of decided to mentor her and teach her.
And then helped her get into Juilliard. And then she got into Juilliard and she had this amazing piano training.
And I think it's important, a white woman.
Yes.
Which is very interesting.
Exactly.
Of where she was at the time. As a black girl.
And then she was eventually part of the whole civil rights movement, and she was connected to some very powerful people from the political civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
But her snobbery as far as a piano player is concerned, she would walk into a venue and she would not start playing until she was 100% ready.
No, until you all sit still.
Exactly.
Give her a moment, listen carefully, and keep quiet.
Yeah, so she was known to allow the audience to sit there for up to half an hour while she got ready. She was like, I'm not ready yet. Like, I'm not feeling the movement, you know? Like, I'm not moved by the scenario. So, I mean, I aspire to be that much of a diva one day. Like, I will only do this when I'm good and ready. And I think that's fair. Like, if you're going to give your best performance, and this is a thing that people don't think about, but like, sometimes you go to a dinner.
Yeah.
And people in Joburg, the first question they like to ask you at a dinner is, what do you do for a living? You know, I think it's apparently a Joburg thing. It doesn't happen anywhere else in this country.
Really?
Yeah, but apparently Joburg people, they want to know what you do for a living. Everyone's very interested.
So what do you do?
Yeah, what do you do for a living? And so when I'm in a situation.
So boring.
Yeah, it's very boring.
It's so boring.
Except for when you tell people you're a musician, then because their stuff is so boring, they're like, oh my gosh, that's so interesting. You're a musician? Yes, I am. Okay.
But if everybody hates the question, which I think they do, why does everybody still ask?
Exactly. And then you tell them you're a musician, and then the automatic response is, oh my gosh, can't you sing something for us? I was like, of course. I would live for this moment. You know, like, my life is not complete enough without having to sing for you this dinner while I'm eating
I've
this.
I've been waiting for you to ask.
While I'm eating this piece of pumpkin because it's Halloween. I'm going to have my pumpkin and then I'm going to sing a little licky for you. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like, do you not understand that I'm a professional? This is what I do for a living. So if I'm going to sing,
Come on, sing for us.
I need to warm up my voice. Mm. I need to be psychologically prepared for this performance. Me, I can't remember lyrics. So usually I'll do very long notes to try and cover the fact that I can't remember my lyrics. I mean, I haven't learned my lyrics. I don't know the lyrics to the song. I am not 100% ready. And the Nina Simone thing, I just think is like, I think it's
take
more...
Take me seriously.
Exactly. It was more like, this is the principle of the matter.
Yeah.
Like, I am a classically trained, Juilliard-trained musician. If I'm going to do this thing, I need to be 100% ready to deliver this performance.
Look, let us not forget, she also had her other demons.
She did. Yeah. Other mental health issues.
And, I mean, it was also a terrible time for a black woman in America.
Oh, indeed.
So let's also,
exactly. So she needed to prove a point, which is like, this is the principle of the matter. I will only deliver this thing when I'm good and ready.
Mm.
And when I'm good and ready, I will deliver it. Because also the other thing is, let's say the dinner party situation, you then do the song and it's not 100%. Why isn't it 100%? You're not warm. Your voice is not warm. You don't remember the lyrics. Mm. You're not going to hit the notes.
Mm.
And then people are like, oh, yeah, well, he's not
and
that great.
And they would expect a black woman not to know what she's doing.
Exactly. And so I think she was 100% justified in making that audience wait for half an hour so that she could get herself good and ready so that when that performance is finally delivered, it is brilliant.
So you know the story about how she was... she got angry.
With her manager. Yes. With the
record label.
I love that interview.
Yes.
I love it.
Where she was supposed to get paid and they didn't pay her.
And then the interviewer says
and the rumor was that she had stabbed...
That she had taken out a knife. To attack this guy who hadn't paid her money.
And then she clarified it.
And then she was like,
it was a gun.
It was a gun. And then they were like, but did you shoot him? And she's like, yes. I did. I shot him and I missed him. And I regret the fact that I missed him. Because I should have got him and I didn't. And I just love that story because it's like, it's so Nina Simone. I mean, she was so honest about everything. And she used to say how much she hated the Americans. She hated America and she didn't even step foot back in America and she died outside of America.
I think you're right. It was a matter of principle. If you owe me money
to give me my money.
Because she did think that the record label had just swindled her out of her money.
Exactly. And she was coming after them.
She went there.
But I mean, you know, another one that was notorious for being so forward about the money was Aretha Franklin.
Oh,
Aretha Franklin, she wouldn't even do the performance if there wasn't a bag. She insisted on getting paid in cash, cash money, and she would not get up on that stage until she saw the bag of money. Otherwise, she was not getting on. She wasn't doing the performance.
Well, she would because, you know, these promoters.
Exactly. Mm. And I think it's, especially as a black musician at that time, you needed to be hardcore about these things. And people will, oh, she's a diva, da, 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 da. It's like, at the end of the day, you can call me whatever you want. I got my money. I was able to pay the bills. And that is the important thing.
Now, because I'm just imagining the scenario of Nina Simone going to the record label saying, it's enough now.
Yeah.
I want my money. I want...
And I want it right now.
And then
I'm not leaving
here. She took a gun.
Exactly.
She took a gun.
And you know what? I think more people
shot the bloody people. It missed, but the point was made.
And in future, no one was going to mess with her.
I want my money.
And I think that is such an important. I think people too often bow down to pressure and they step back. And then they complain about the fact that they didn't get what they wanted. And the only reason why you didn't get what you want is because you weren't willing to shoot someone.
Yeah, this is it.
And
this
I mean that, you know, metaphorically.
She wasn't being metaphorical.
Not literally, but with her, it was literal.
She was
like, she literally shot the dude.
Shoot somebody, they didn't believe her, and she shot.
Yeah, she shot them. I mean, she didn't get the guy. But she proved her point, and I think that's the important thing. And I mean, I live my life like that as well. I mean, I'm not going around shooting people. Like, I don't make a habit of, like, going around with a gun and shooting people. But I am a very strong believer that if you want something, you've got to be upfront about it and you've got to tell people about it. Otherwise, you've only got yourself to blame.
I don't think that we knew that Sheldon could come out with a gun to shoot us.
I'm not shooting anybody.
But we continue our beautiful music tribute to Halloween. So we're going to now play Rihanna.
Yeah. So are we going to talk about it? All right, so this is the newest song out of the whole lot because we had Michael Jackson 1982 and then we had 1968 with the other songs, the 1950s. And this is the newest, the youngest song of them all, Rihanna 2008. And it was from a reissued version of her third studio album called Good Girl Gone Bad.
Yeah.
Called Good Girl Gone Bad Reloaded. Anyway, the song was written by Chris Brown and his team. Mm. Oh, and now Breezy's coming to South Africa and there's a whole lot of controversy surrounding his imminent arrival. But anyway, he wrote this song with his team of songwriters and he was going to release it on his album called Exclusive in 2007. But then when he finished writing the song, he was like, this song is not a boy song. It's a girl song. He didn't feel that he could give, he could do the song the justice that it required because he felt that it was more written from a woman's perspective. Anyway, he offered the song to Rihanna, and Rihanna recorded the song, and she loved it. She was like, this song is brilliant. Now, the way she talks about the song, although she didn't write it, but the way she talks about it, it's a song about like, it's about anxiety and anguish and depression, and that's what the song is reflecting on. And she, when she finished recording the song, she went to L.A. Reid, who was her record company head at the time, Def Jam, and she said, I want you to release this song. And apparently L.A. Reid, dealing with Rihanna in all the years, had never had her be so militant about wanting to release a specific song. Anyway, he was like, oh, if this is what you really want, then we will release the song. And the song was released and it went to number one. So she was on the money with the song, and so was Chris Brown, by thinking, you know, this song is actually, I'm not going to be able to do it justice. And sometimes I think the important message with this song is that, like, sometimes you need to know your limitations. And I think people are just not real with themselves. In the law, like, because I studied law, in law, the test that is used is a reasonable man test, which is like, you need to assess the situation and establish from a reasonable person's perspective, is this going to work or not going to work? Or is this a good defense or not a good defense? And I think that reasonable man test, we don't use enough in our own daily lives. We do things that we think we're going to be good at, but we're not being honest with ourselves. And I think that honesty with yourself and with assessing a situation is such a crucial element in the success of anything that you do. And in this instance, Chris Brown was sensible and was like, this song's not going to work for me. I'm not going to be able to do it justice. I believe someone else will be able to do it justice, and gives it to Rihanna, and she then takes the song and makes it a massive number one hit. 9 million units sold around the world. It was humongous. And just by being real.
She's punchy, hey?
She's amazing.
She's punchy.
I love the fact that I was actually speaking about this earlier today, how especially in the arts, you don't, like, although you may think, you may start off by going, I'm going to be a rock star. That's what I'm going to do. Your career doesn't stay like that. It meanders through many different iterations. And with Rihanna, I mean, she started off as, I don't think she does music anymore. I think she dabbles in music now. But Fenty is the big thing.
Fenty is her thing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar. Yeah, it's like the newest luxury brand in the world.
Yeah.
I think it's part of LVMH.
Yeah.
And that's like singer, model, actress. She's done some acting, and then this cosmetics thing, which is huge, because other people have tried cosmetics,
so
and
many
hasn't
people
worked.
So many people have failed in cosmetics.
Exactly.
So many people have
and
failed.
She's done so well. It's such an aspirational brand, and everyone wants to be part of it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that it's a black woman in charge of this, like a cosmetics empire.
And I mean, as you said, there are many Bobby Browns and all of that who peak and then don't disappear.
And so it's really nice to see a brand like that, Fenty, which has become this aspirational luxury brand, which is amazing.
Would you go watch, what's his name again? The partner?
No.
Chris Brown.
Definitely
what's
not.
What's his name again?
Yeah. I've never been a big Chris Brown fan. I never got the hype around it. But and then with the GBV thing, I'm like, I don't know. And people have found ways to excuse the whole thing. I don't know. I don't know enough about the story. But I just think, yeah, those pictures of Rihanna did not look great after he was done with her.
And I mean, generally, your thoughts about musicians who would then be, I suppose, just where we have to make decisions about whether to continue playing them or not play them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, in this instance, I mean, we just played Disturbia, which means Chris Brown's going to get a royalty for that. The thing with Chris Brown is that I've just never been a fan of his music, so it's not like I would ever play it because I'm just not a fan. But it's a difficult one because it's such a difficult one. Like, you think of like R. Kelly or...
I struggled with not listening to R. Kelly because he was so good.
Yes.
But
the music was really good.
This is the point. Yeah. The music was brilliant.
Yeah.
But absolutely not. I do not want a penny to go to R. Kelly. So
No playing
R. Kelly.
Yeah. For me. Actually, I was listening to a Celine Dion album the other day on Spotify, and the R. Kelly song was not there. The famous R. Kelly Celine Dion "I'm Your Angel" duet was not there.
It was removed. I think he needs to starve.
Yeah. But it's a difficult one because from a historical archival point of view, it means that element's now been removed, which then places the rest of the artists that have come before and after him in a bit of a, like, how do they fit into the whole
thing? Like a P. Diddy.
Yeah, P. Diddy, it's another one.
P. Diddy needs to stop earning money.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a difficult one from an archival historical point of view, but it's understandable. Like, I was at a party a while ago, and they were playing like a whole sequence of R. Kelly songs. This is cringing. A bit inappropriate.
You're cringing. Where have you been?
Yeah.
What are you thinking? Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And when you listen to the songs, like, you remind me of my Jeep. It's like,
no.
What are we talking about here?
No.
Or I don't feel nothing wrong.
No. Nah. You see, now my heart is starting to race.
Although they were brilliant songs.
My blood pressure is going up.
I believe I can fly. Brilliant song, but how do we?
P. Diddy needs to stop earning a living.
Yeah.
R. Kelly needs to stop earning a living. Like, yeah. Period.
Yeah, completely. But you take P. Diddy out, you take Notorious B.I.G. out.
P. Diddy needs to stop earning a living.
But if you don't,
No. P. Diddy needs to stop.
Which means Notorious B.I.G. is out as well, because that's P. Diddy as well.
It means many songs by P. Diddy need to stop being played. And unfortunately, it's going to hurt other people.
It is.
But
it is.
P. Diddy needs to stop earning it.
Yeah.
Like, stop.
Yeah.
Now.
I mean, the stories are just,
because you see what that money was able to do.
Sure.
That power. The corruption. It bought him so much power. Mm. And that's the unfortunate bit.
And entitlement.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.